For the week of February 12th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 355, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still in Birmingham, Michael.
I'm still in Birmingham.
Okay.
I'll be going back to New York probably in a week and a half. But, you know, I'll be there in March. Though there was, the theater is starting up again, Broadway season. There's sort of a month-long pause. But there was a period about a week and a half ago where I had seen every single show on Broadway. It hasn't happened in 25 years, but it finally happened that every show on Broadway, previews, long runners, everything, I've seen them all, every single show on Broadway. Now, again, a few new shows have started up, so I got to get back to New York and watch them and see them. But it was kind of cool for one moment to have seen everything from A to Z on the Great White Way.
Well, and, it's good that you did that now because, in a couple months, you won't be able to, have all that free time to go out.
Why not?
We've been debating when we should announce this, Michael, but I think now is as good a time as any. We should let our listeners know, and some of our longtime listeners might already know, that we're expecting twins, actually, you and I. Just like Beyonce and Jay-Z and George and Amal Clooney. Oh, I mean, they announced that last week. Yeah, and they got tons of ratings. They got tons of press. Come on, if we announce it, we're bound to get that much press.
I didn't even know we were trying.
Oh, well, so then we don't have to adopt the twins?
No, we don't. But if we did have twins and they were listening to the show, what would they hear about on this week's?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about the Grammy Awards. We're flying solo on this because our guest, David Wilde, he's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. And of course, he wrote the Grammys last night with producer Ken Ehrlich. He can't make it this year. Look, he had his schedule jammed up with work on a tribute to the Bee Gees, which is filming for CBS this week. And he did that after working on the Grammys. He's barely staying alive.
Keep going.
Hopefully we'll have him back on the show soon to get the latest on what's happening with him. However, we will analyze the show and wonder if hashtag Grammy's so white and how in God's name Beyonce thinks she's going to headline Coachella in 8 weeks. Maybe she'll give birth on stage. Now, I would pay to see that. The Grammys aren't the only awards happening, so we'll check out the latest about the Oscars and really the BAFTAs, including how politics is invading the red carpet and, who won some of those BAFTAs and what they might mean for artists hoping to clutch a gold statue before all is said and done. During our book filter segment, Michael will tout the book that everyone else is touting. Hey, sometimes you have to admit that the big book of the week is indeed the book that everyone else is talking about. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at Paramount's plans to make like Mickey Mouse and try to imitate Disney's approach to movie making. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, and we also pull info from Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, everybody. And it's a good week at the box office because we have 3 to 5 new hit films that debut. They all look like they're winners. One of them there may be an asterisk by, but that's a pretty good week. And the number one movie around the world, Spanky Spanky, it's 50 Shades Darker, $150 million on its opening weekend. They pretty much tripled their reported budget. So that's a hell of a start for the SM franchise.
You mean S and M?
SM. You don't say S and M.
Okay, well, see.
It's sadomasochism. It's not sadomasochism.
Okay, well, what I will say is that...
You need to be punished.
Oh, I get it, because of the SA, I get it. Well, it opened to $40 million in North America. What did it open to?
$47 million in North America.
Which is $40 million down from 50 Shades of Grey.
That's fine. Actually, audiences seem to like it a little better. It's not as god-awful as the first one. It's certainly not getting good reviews, but it may have a little better legs. But yeah, no, of course, the first one was, a fluke, but... They're clearly going to be okay. They've got three movies. They'll make all three of them for a decent amount of money, and they'll make their dollar back.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't shock you that 70% of the people who saw this movie in North America this weekend were female.
It does shock me, because if I was a guy and I had a girlfriend, I would absolutely want to take her to see 50 Shades Darker. What the hell? You know, of course, I would take her to, what was that, the stripper one with Channing Tatum?
Oh, Showgirls?
Yeah, No, not Showgirls. Magic Mike.
Magic Mike. Okay.
I'm taking my girlfriend to Magic Mike. I'm taking her to... What do you say? Go with your girlfriends? No. You take her to the movie and then you have fun. I don't get it. Why would you not want to take your girlfriend to that movie? If you got kids, you might want to take them to the Lego Batman movie. Another one of the big hits that opened up this week. $92 million opening up around the world. And it turned what was kind of a fluke, the Lego movie. Great reviews, very fun movie. And they said, we have a franchise. And I thought, really? But yes, they do. It's not just they spun off Batman here. They got a second Lego movie in that original series coming out. And by God, it kind of worked really well.
And so, it's got some runway here. And it's got some runway here in North America with no family films opening for the next 2 weeks. But it opens in China March 3rd.
This is a very successful movie. Both of them are very well reviewed. The Lego movies, that is. So that's you know, you're making good movies that adults like and kids like, and it's distinctive and different, even though it's in sort of the superhero genre, it's its own wholly different thing. So that's great. And it's an $80 million budget. So they made their money back. And I mean, they matched their budget on opening weekend. That's always a good sign. They made $6 million in IMAX worldwide. So, and not a word, however, about 3D. It was available in 3D. You saw the showtimes diminishing over the opening weekend. Kids typically these days are not big fans of wearing the glasses. If there was good news to say, I imagine they would have reported it.
As they always do.
There was better news for XXX, The Return of Xander Cage. That did open in China and had a big weekend there. It made $70 million worldwide. So now it's at $230 million. So it's pretty much tripled its budget. It didn't do very well at all in North America, about $43 million and counting. It's pretty much done here, I think. But overseas, it's made $190 million. So that's really where it's happening. You can look at the cast and see how they said, hey, let's represent the world, baby. It's the UN casting approach to movies. You know, they did it with the Fast and Furious. Now they've done it with XXX, and it's smart and it's paying off.
And just to give you some sense as to the scale of the Chinese market, it made, this is XXX, the Xander Cage film, $61.9 million. It was opening weekend. It's the largest opening for a Hollywood film in February, which kind of means something and kind of doesn't. Because remember, a lot of times February is off limits because that's when the Lunar New Year happens, the Chinese New Year. So there's a blackout for Hollywood films. This year it happened a little earlier, so some of the big Hollywood blockbusters could open in February. But get this, it opened in 6,600 locations, not on 6,600 screens, but in 6,600 different locations. That's pretty remarkable.
Or to put it in simpler terms, it made more in its opening weekend in China than it's made in its entire run in North America.
Okay, well, that's actually doing a much simpler job. Yes, that's actually a much, yes.
And at number four, another hit film. This one I so much want to see. John Wick, Chapter 2, $40 million on its opening weekend. It's playing at a drive-in here in Birmingham, Alabama. I want to see it so bad, but I've promised friends who I saw the first one with that I will wait till we get back to New York and we'll all see it together in 2 weekends. So the Keanu Reeves movie, the first one, a classic slow builder where it had a modest opening, got good word of mouth, and then exploded in the home. People saw it streaming or digital downloads or DVDs, however they saw it, they liked it. Great word of mouth for the movie. The new one got really good reviews as well. So it looks like a fun franchise. And hey, they say it cost about $40 million. I'm not sure what sort of asterisk there is by that because Keanu gets some money. Maybe he has profit participation, but they made that back opening weekend. This will definitely have legs and we're going to see Chapter 3.
Yeah, indeed. It actually shows you how a film which kind of finds a lot of its audience on home video, how the sequel can actually break out of the gate, unlike the original film. John Wick Chapter 2 more than doubled the first film's opening.
Yeah, it almost tripled it. And it got good reviews. The first one was goofy, silly, massively violent. I've never seen so many headshots in my life. And I don't mean actor profiles. I mean, everybody he killed, he shot in the head. It was just insane. It was, I couldn't stop laughing. I love the movie.
And it was all because somebody killed his dog.
Well, yeah, that would piss me off too. And number five is Split, the M. Night Shyamalan film, $17 million over the weekend and $170 million worldwide. And number six is Oscar hopeful La La Land. That opens on Valentine's Day in China. $16 million over the weekend, just under $300 million worldwide. That's 10 times the reported budget for this movie, and it's a lot of money for a live-action musical.
Now, is the film called La La Land in China?
I don't know.
And I say that because I know that the L is not a pronounced letter in Chinese. That's why I ask that.
In China, it will be called California Country.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. At number seven, Jackie Chan is doing great. Of all the movies that opened up in China over the big New Year's festival, I feel like this one is proving to have the best legs. Kung Fu Yoga, sort of a Raiders of the Lost Ark style comedy. It's a co-production with India. It made $16 million over the weekend, and it's at $230 million worldwide. But more importantly, I think it's got good word of mouth. I feel like it's Jackie Chan back on top in a way. He's never gone away, but I feel like this is a late career click for him.
Well, think about it. As he got older, and as he's gotten older, you know, I know I'm not as flexible as I used to be in my 20s. And, you know, this is a guy that's broken more bones than I have in my body. So, you know, I can imagine he's like, yeah, you know, maybe I won't do as many stunts anymore.
Yeah, he's always relied on comedy. He's always been a very physical, funny actor, combining stunts and martial arts with, you know, Buster Keaton style hijinks. And I think he's like, hey, how about a few more pies in the face?
Huh? Yeah, exactly.
Number eight is Rings, the horror flick franchise. $15 million over the weekend, $52 million worldwide. And number nine, another movie that opened up. This one is a Chinese Hong Kong comedy. It's called Cook Up a Storm. I'm not sure if this is a hit because I don't know what the budget was, but it grossed $12 million on its opening weekend. However, the tracking is very bad. It's dropped from Friday to Sunday, or whatever day it opened up. Every day it was doing more and more poorly. So this is clearly not having good word of mouth. So this is one of the five movies I said could be considered a hit. Three of them are lock solid hits. I know about that because we have more information. Cook Up a Storm, I'm a little blind on. I don't know the budget. And I have noticed that when I go back on the second week to look up online and try to find out what the budget is of a movie that opened up in India or China or Korea, more and more, I'm finding people filling in that information or citing a source. So there's better coverage of all these movies worldwide. And if you know what the budget is for Cook Up a Storm, if you can tell us whether it's a hit or not, let us know.
Yeah, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can reach out to us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can reach us on our Facebook page. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up, and we do respond to those who leave messages there.
That's right. And similarly to Cook Up a Storm, we have Duckweed, which is a Chinese drama. It has a father-son dynamic. And like the Jackie Chan movie, it's showing very good legs, $12 million over the weekend, $125 million worldwide. Virtually all of that is from China. It's in four territories, including here in North America, as is, I think Cook Up a Storm might be here too. No, Duckweed is, and a couple others are. But it's fascinating to see how many of these movies do open up in the U.S. day and date. They're not making a lot of money, but at least they're giving people the opportunity to not steal a copyrighted, a counterfeit copy of the movie. And at number 11 is Jolly LLB 2. It's a sequel to a Bollywood black comedy about the legal system. We talked about that first one when it opened up in Bollywood in India. And now here we are talking about the sequel. Nobody else talks about these movies unless they come to the U.S. and make a lot of money. They cover the worldwide box office when it involves U.S. movies, but they're not always good about covering the big movies in other countries. That's what we love to do. And this one made $12 million on its opening weekend. It was written and directed by Subhash Kapoor, and we think the budget is about $5 million. So that's an excellent launch for that movie. Maybe it's a franchise, or maybe it's just they squeezed out an extra sequel.
Well, and it made $780,000 here in North America this weekend. And I mention that because you'd think, well, that's not that much money. It's under $1 million. But it actually beat out the Oscar-nominated short films, which were playing on 184 screens here in North America, which made $660,000 and came in number 21 in North America. What I would say is I'm surprised that it did that well.
Well, how many screens was it on?
184.
The Jolly LLB 2.
Oh, that I cannot tell you. I'll look that up while you move on to our next film.
That's right. It's another Oscar hopeful. It's Hidden Figures, which may not have a good night at the Oscars, I don't think. It's not going to it's going to be a rough time for it. I don't think they're going to get much of anything, but they have had huge success at the box office, and they got lots of Oscar nominations, so they can take that to the bank. $10 million this weekend, $150 million worldwide. Sing, the animated movie, just passed the $500 million mark, as we told you it would last weekend. And looking down for something new to say, the new movie opened up in Korea. It's called Fabricated City. And can we make like a dinging sound, like ding, 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 ding? Do we have like a Wall Street, you know, closing of the bell system thing on here?
Every time I've tried to introduce sound effects, you always say, hey, we're not a morning zoo show.
That's right. But if we were a morning zoo show, we would have a clanging bell, because Fabricated City is ripe for remake as far as I'm concerned. So Hollywood, pay attention. It's about a hot young dude in Korea who's unemployed in the real world, but online he's a top gamer and he's super cool. Meaning, you know, he plays video games online, not that he's in some alternate reality. But anyway, life is going fine, even though he's unemployed, until suddenly he finds himself being arrested by the cops and accused of raping and killing some high school girl. And now he has to go out and clear his name. So you got gamers, you got murder, you got a young hot guy on the lam. I think Hollywood should come a calling. But this movie made $7 million on its opening weekend in Korea.
And you asked how many screens Jolly LLB 2 was on in North America, where it made $780,000, came in 16th place. It was on 173 screens, so 11 screens fewer than the Oscar-nominated short films.
Right. So, but it's not like it was on four screens and did a great per-screen average. This isn't going to break out and become a big hit in North America.
No, I don't think so.
No. So that's most of the movies. There's always more. You can check out our charts. One movie that I skipped over is Lion, another Oscar hopeful. And who knows? Maybe it'll win Best Cinematography or Best Supporting Actor. We don't expect it to, but it's coming on strong in that area. It made $7 million over the weekend. It's at $65 million worldwide. And you have to admire and tip your hat to the Weinstein Company, which have turned this movie into a film you have to talk about and pay attention to. It's not always easy. And this weekend, I felt bad for David Glasser. He's the Weinstein Company COO. And talking about it, he said, quote, "This is a zeitgeist movie. As people discover it, you wouldn't believe the emails that are pouring in. Every day we wake up to notes from politicians, tennis players, even a woman I know from Middle America, all saying this couldn't be more timely." I'm like, even a person in Middle America saw the movie.
Unbelievable.
And tennis players. Tennis players? But God bless him. He's got a hit film. He's doing his best. They're pushing it for the Oscars. So full credit for bringing up the tennis player contingent at the Oscars. The people who play tennis will be like, you know, I play tennis. Maybe I should vote for Lion. You never know what'll happen.
Well, do you think that film will open in China?
I do not. I haven't spotted an official release date in China yet for Lion. So I don't know.
Well, these days, it very well might. I mean, it's not the type of film that would normally open in China because they're looking for big Hollywood blockbusters rather than kind of small to medium-sized independent films. But, right now, February 2017, this is the time when the quota, it's now 34 films allowed into China every year, and it ends this month. So that little, treaty, if you will, it ends this month, and they're saying now it's not going to go back down to 20, but it might expand. To which, what do we say, Michael?
We said we already said it expanded.
Right, exactly. It's already expanded because, you know, they're letting more films in now. The Chinese government is letting more films, not only from Hollywood, but other countries as well, because they have so many movie theaters and they need to put something on those screens.
That's right. They say, oh, that's not part of the quota. That's just a cultural exchange.
Right. Know?
So they're just labeling them differently. Yeah. So the state newspapers in China are predicting the quota will grow. There'll be more movies allowed. And more importantly, that the share of revenue Hollywood gets will move towards the 40% of box office revenue that is the international standard. That's according to the Hollywood Reporter. They're quoting these reports in the state news. And of course, if it's a state newspaper, that means it's going to happen, because there's always factions in the government fighting each other, but at least they're laying the groundwork to make it happen. But as we've pointed out, they've already loosened the standards. We've already got 14 movies scheduled to open up in China through early March. So we've already got 14 big Hollywood movies that are already scheduled within the first 3 months of this calendar year, and we're still adding more in. So they're clearly going to blow past the quota, but the revenue sharing, that interests me.
Well, you know, we always said, Michael, and anybody that's listened to Showbiz Sandbox for any length of time, for at least the last 3 or 4 years, we've been saying, look, here's what's going to happen. They're going to build 40, 50,000 screens in all of these multiplexes, not only in urban areas, but in second and third tier cities. And you're going to need product to put on those shelves. And they're going to need it, whether it's from China or whether it's from Korea or Japan or India or Hollywood. They're going to need that. And one way to get it is to pay a bigger percentage and to let more films in. And that's exactly what's happening.
Right. They said it won't get to 40%, but they said it will grow again, and maybe not as much as the last leap forward, which I think was about not a 10% leap, but a leap in 10%, meaning from like 12% to 25% or whatever they bumped it up to. It was a pretty good jump. And they're saying, well, don't expect that much Yankee running imperialist dog, but maybe it'll be a healthy jump. I would just say, hey, you've got Fantastic Beasts 2, you've got the next Star Wars, you've got the next Avengers. They need it. This is business, you know, they meaning, hey, it's a business. You want to get more money from your movie. Everybody wants to get as much money for their movie as they can. But they say it's a 40% international standard. And I was wondering about that because we know in North America, the studios get 50%. Is that about where it is for most countries?
It's more of like a 40% international average.
But that seems higher than I expected because I thought at most you were getting 40%. Most countries you're getting 40% or less.
Yes, but most of the time it's 40% around the 40% mark. Yes.
Okay. So most countries are at about 40%, but China is sort of an outlier.
Because it's not on a country by country basis. Sometimes, like, you know, you open a Marvel film and you'll have, you know, Disney come in and say, no, we're getting 55 to 60% on this film because they're Marvel and they're Disney and they can get it.
Oh, okay. So it's not as much territory by territory as it is studio by studio or film by film?
Correct. Absolutely.
But they don't like to go back and forth and negotiate for every single darn movie, right? Don't they basically say, you want more Disney movies, you're going to have to give us this percentage?
Yes and no. It depends on the territory. In some cases, there are actual laws where it's actually pegged and they don't do that.
Like France or something?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. France, I think they do negotiate. But like in the UK, no, it's negotiated week by week. So,
well, speaking of the UK, they had the BAFTA Awards. And, you know, if you're wondering who's going to win at the Oscars, you can look at the BAFTAs and see if there's a modest overlap. But it is sort of people in the industry rather than, you know, critics or some other groups. So it has a certain weight behind it. And the usual suspects are picking it up. La La Land won picture, director, and actress and cinematography. Casey Affleck won for Manchester by the Sea and so on. The Jungle Book won for best special effects. So it's most of the usual films you would expect to be in the running. I don't think it really changes anything come Oscar time. And the best British film of the year that they honored is Ken Loach's I, Daniel Blake, which you saw at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yes, and it was one of Ken Loach's more accessible films. I'm not saying his films are inaccessible, but it was certainly more commercial. I'm surprised it didn't play bigger here, or maybe it hasn't even been released. I don't know. But
I believe it was released, and I'm not surprised it didn't play well. I mean, it's, you know, it's a dour, downbeat little movie.
yeah, about British social issues. Just a point here, and I was actually going to use this as a transition point. We don't know whether Lion will open in China, but at the BAFTAs, Best Supporting Actor, Dev Patel, and Best Adapted Screenplay. You know, right now, Mahershala Ali is kind of the front runner for Best Supporting Actor. Do you think this changes anything?
No.
Still, so
because it's the British, it's the, you know, like I said, it's there's a modest overlap. So it's less telling than a Guild or the SAG Awards. You know, all these are just tea leaves. And I think the ones that really matter are the Guilds. Everybody else is a distraction. The Globes, the BAFTAs, the critic groups, that's all a distraction. Focus on the Guilds, and that gives you at least a hint of what some of the people who actually vote on the Oscars are doing. But it never hurts to have momentum and have people say, you know, sounds like it's a movie I need to check out. And yes, people did check out I, Daniel Blake because it opened up in the U.S. on December 23rd. Happy holiday viewing.
Well, yeah, not really. Now, do you think Ryan Gosling is out there going, hey, man, I learned how to play piano for this movie. I'm in this movie, too.
No, I think he's just fine.
OK,
I think he's you know, he's thrilled to be in an Oscar, a movie that's going to win Best Picture. I'm sure actors have egos, so I'm sure he's like, why aren't I winning a Best Actor? But sure, I think he's just along for the ride and happy to do it. Let's him make all the movies he wants to make. It was kind of a roll of the dice. But one should never underestimate the ego of an actor. So you may have a good point.
Well, you know, we just mentioned I, Daniel Blake, which is a, kind of a rather political movie. Not surprising, given that it's Ken Loach, the director, and Paul Laverty, the screenwriter.
But, because they care about people.
Yes, and apparently so does UTA, the United Talent Agency here in Hollywood, and of course elsewhere. They represent, you know, well, talent, really. Actors, actresses, writers, directors, producers, production companies, sports stars. But they have decided, you know what? We're not gonna have an Oscar party this year. We're going to instead have a refugee rally.
Yes, that sounds so much fun.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get an invite.
I'm not sure what they're planning. It's a symbolic step, and nobody else has followed. CAA and WME, IMG, ICM. They're like, yeah, we're gonna have our parties. Maybe does UTA have a big front runner in the Oscar race this year? Do they have a big movie? Is that a good question?
Well, remember, agencies don't have movies. They have clients.
Yes,
that are.
Yes, they do.
They have clients.
If they had Damien Chazelle and Emma Stone, they would have a big movie.
Correct. That is absolutely correct. If they had, you know, maybe they packaged a movie or they have the director of a movie, they really can't play favorites because sometimes they'll have like four of the directors that are nominated. So I don't know whether that's the case this time.
I was just wondering if they didn't have a big dog in the fight this year, because I'm sure you have good years and bad years just like studios do.
Yes, that is true. I think in this case, they're trying to make a statement by saying, look, you know, we should really...
And I'm making a statement that, you know, maybe they don't have Hidden Figures or La La Land or any big talent going up for big awards. So it's not that big a deal for them to say we're not going to have a party.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, William Morris, ICM, and Creative Artists Agency have said, well, just more people will come to ours then.
Yeah. Well, William Morris, Endeavor, and IMG, which is one big company, they said, we'll see your refugee rally and raise you a pack. Because Rahm Emanuel at that agency, he once had Trump as a client. He even visited him at Orthanc before Trump took office after he'd been elected. I mean, Trump Tower, not Orthanc. But he visited Trump there, though we still don't know what they talked about. But he's now said that they're going to form a PAC to represent their interests in D.C. And they said, we have diverse people at our agency and we want to respect everybody's viewpoints, but we want to make sure I'm not sure, you know, don't they lobby already? You know, that's my first comment.
Not really. Not to the extent that you think they would.
Unlike the studios, the talent agencies don't really play it they don't find much need to be heard in D.C.
No, they have their clients for that. You know,
they've got a PAC and they don't want to offend their clients who are Trump supporters, but they're going to have a PAC and they're going to do stuff. But everybody's welcome. So
it wasn't Rahm Emanuel. OK, it was Ari Emanuel. OK,
Ari Emanuel. Rahm would be the other guy.
Rahm was the former chief of staff for President Obama and now the mayor of Chicago. But yeah, I can't imagine what Ari Emanuel and Trump talked about. Maybe he was asking, you know, whether he could still host the Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice. I think I could do both. Ask anyone.
There was a new host of the Grammy Awards this week, though, wasn't there?
That's right. That's right. So let's talk about the Grammy Awards. James Corden took over for LL Cool J.
He was embarrassed.
He was embarrassed. Why do you say that?
Because every joke he made was self-deprecating.
I know that I did not understand. I thought maybe one or two jokes would be self-deprecating because he's James Corden and that's kind of his shtick. But literally from the opening moments all the way through to the end, it was, you know, just one self-deprecating joke after another.
It was like he was Ricky Gervais in The Office. You know, it was just constant making fun of himself. But I don't know that's his shtick. I don't get that on late night. I get him just as the fun, friendly guy. You know, like a Jimmy Fallon. He's just fun. I don't see him as mocking himself constantly, but maybe I don't watch his show that much. But I don't know. I thought it got very tiresome very quickly. But again, I'm not watching this show for stand-up bits. So every time they do a stand-up bit, I'm like, oh, you know, please. We don't need filler in a three-and-a-half-hour show.
Wait a second. So I do watch it for some of those bits because for two reasons. Number one, of course, David Wilde helps write some of those. So I want to, you know, and usually he's a guest on the show the day after the Grammys, and I want to be able to have, you know, something to ask him about. And number two, sometimes they are quite funny. This year there were some that worked and some that didn't, but there's sometimes they are needed because you need a moment for the production crews to switch a set around. So that's what they're used for.
You can have somebody giving an introductory speech, or there's millions of ways to fill time without, you know, comedy bits. But no, comedy is, you know, a little humor to keep it going along. That's fine. But the less the better. I feel the same way about the Oscars and the Tonys and the Grammys. The less the better in terms of the host. You're not there to do stuff. You're there just to keep the ball rolling. But they kept it rolling. The ratings were up just a tick over the last 2 years. 26 million people overnights plus. I think that's the overnights plus some of the same day DVR usage. And that's where most of the info will come on the Grammys. You won't see people watching it, you know, a week later. If there's any clips they watch, it's probably going to be isolated clips on YouTube. But the ratings are up, so they did well. There did seem to be quite a few technical flubs.
Yeah, well, the biggest one I would say was with the Metallica Lady Gaga performance. They played Moth to a Flame, Metallica song, and James Hetfield's mic was turned off. So the song starts and you can hear the music, and then he starts screaming into the microphone as only he does, and you can't hear a word he's saying.
Like, I know, and I love that stuff. It must be a nightmare for them, but at least we know it's live.
Yeah, no.
You know, it's fun. It's fun. You're like, yay, it's human. They're happening.
Well, you know, we kind of buried the lead here, which is, you know, Adele won all of the Grammys that she was nominated for. I think, what was it, 4 or 5 Grammys she was nominated for, and she won all of the top awards. But of course, speaking of live, she was doing a tribute to George Michael, who passed away on Christmas Day, last Christmas. And you know what? She decided, hey, I started this off key. I'm going to start over. And right on live TV, okay, she used a profane word, probably not great. She apologized to Ken Ehrlich. She said, I know this is live TV. I apologize, Ken. I'd like to start over. And she started the whole song over.
Yeah, she did. And again, that when people loved it. She's real. She cursed. She starts over. She feels emotional about, you know, George Michael, who I imagine she knew and respected and admired. So that's just all good. It's all good live. And I think during Maren Morris's acceptance speech, I think it was hers, sounded like somebody was testing out a drum or maybe hammering something backstage because there was suddenly this loud rat-a-tat-tat-tat going on while she started to talk. But there you go. My favorite moment of the whole show was when the two guys took off their pants.
Yes. Okay. So this is 21 Pilots. They win the award for, what is it? Best New Artist, I think they won.
No, they won like best rock vocal or something like that.
Yes. Okay. Best rock vocal because
something like, or pop vocal. I'm not sure. They won at least twice, I believe.
Chance the Rapper won Best New Artist, and then 21 Pilots wins this award, and they're sitting right by the aisle. They step into the aisle. There's Dwight Yoakam sitting right in front of them, wearing his big cowboy hat. And they immediately pull their pants down and take their pants off. And Dwight Yoakam just gives him the old side eye. And I'm just
like
what the heck are you guys doing? All right, whatever.
And why did they do it?
And then they got on stage. And I thought, these bozos. You know, this is why you can't have anything nice. That's all I kept thinking. It's like, this is why, you know, people turn conservative because of bozos like you. But then they actually gave a very touching speech that years ago when they were nobodies, they were sitting around watching the Grammys in their underwear, and they said, look, if we ever make it, if we ever become big time musicians and we are at the Grammys and we win an award, we should accept the award dressed exactly the same way in our underwear. So I thought that was,
and then yeah, and then they
good.
Said, hey, you could do it too, you know.
Yeah, it was kind of like a, hey, if we can be up here wearing our underwear, you can be, you know, you're sitting at home, you can be up here too.
And I thought it was sweet and it was funny, and it does beg the question, however, why were you and your friends sitting around in your underwear watching the Grammy Awards? I mean, I've watched the Grammy Awards in my underwear. I've watched the Grammy Awards with my friends, but I've never watched the Grammy Awards with my friends in our underwear. So I'd like to know personally.
Oh, brother. Well, I would say, okay, we mentioned Adele. We mentioned the underwear folks, 21 Pilots. Adele opens with Hello. I think you actually had a much better opener, I think. We're producing the show ourselves. Since we don't have David Wilde, we can't ask him, why didn't you open this way? But Neil Diamond was there. Why not open with America?
Well, you knew you were going to have Neil Diamond there. You knew they were going to do, you didn't know you were going to have Neil Diamond sing anything, but you knew they were going to do carpool karaoke because that's why James Gordon is nominally there, because he does this musical segment and it's hugely popular. I thought that was fine. And they sang a Neil Diamond song, Sweet Caroline, and brought everybody in kind of like Ellen DeGeneres' Oscar photos flash. I got it. I thought it was fun. But you know what? I was also thinking, this is the political night. People are doing politics. And it's such a crazy world that just flashing the images of the first three words of the Constitution is now a political act. That's how sad our country is, that if you say we the people, you are somehow defying the president. I mean, that's just pathetic, personally. And I've been thinking for a few days about Neil Diamond's song, America, which is about immigrants and the American dream. And it used to be just this milquetoast, I love this country song. Everybody loves that song. You know, they're coming to America. And now it's like, if you sang this song, you could have Neil Diamond get up and say, this shouldn't be a political song, but apparently it is. And then sing this great rousing tribute to America and refugees. And like you said, you had the great idea. They should flash everybody's where they're from, all the Grammy nominees and the country they come from. Neil Diamond's family comes from Russia and Poland. That's where his roots are. And that would have been a great musical, political statement, rather and political, that most people can get behind and say, yeah, that is what I love about America. And I think it would have been better than Adele's Hello. And as you say, it also gets rid of the problem of bringing people back twice.
Yes, I did not necessarily think we needed to see Bruno Mars or even Adele twice. Now, we understand why they do that. They're big names. That's why people tune in. But yeah, do we really need Bruno Mars twice? Do we really need Adele to sing Hello, a song we've seen her sing probably five times on live television? We don't need to see her sing it again. Instead, she did a great job, even though she restarted, she did a great job on Fast Love, which was the George Michael tribute. And Bruno Mars did a stunning job on the Prince tribute. I didn't know he could play guitar that well. And so, you know, we didn't really need to see them twice. Beyonce, you didn't need to see twice because she basically owned a half an hour of the show.
Yeah. I felt like they said it went on so long. It was two songs put together, a huge elaborate production. You can get in a minute to the technical issues, which are pretty stunning. I just thought I was laughing. It was like 10 minutes long. And I thought, whatever you want, Beyonce, you want 15 minutes? You want 20 minutes? What do you want? Do whatever you want, baby. And that's exactly what she did. So more power to her.
Yeah. I mean, so basically what they did was they projected images that were shot earlier, obviously, and she's very pregnant. She's wearing this gold dress. She looks like an Egyptian goddess with the headdress on and everything. And so those were projected on a screen that sometimes actually morphed into her standing there in real life. And the actual production of it was amazing. So amazing, in fact, that I kind of forgot to listen to the words of what was being said and sang. And I was like, this is just unbelievable. Oh, wait, the words probably mean something here. I should probably be paying attention. This is probably a woman power song. And I just completely lost the train of thought that she had because I was so enamored with all the visuals.
Well, there you go. Then job well done. I did have to say, I knew before the show began that she probably wasn't going to win Album of the Year.
Really? You did? You really? I thought for sure, because of the whole Oscar so white thing, that the Recording Academy was going to say, no, we're going to show you guys, we're diverse here. We're going to give, an R&B, a pop star of African-American descent. We're going to give them the top prize.
Well, but before the show is when they give out most of the awards. There are about 10 awards given out on the show, and I think 75 or 85 are given out before.
That's something that a lot of people don't know, that if you are nominated for a Grammy, when you go to the Grammys that night, you are there all day. I mean, you start at noon, and you're there.
It's gotta be exhausting.
Yeah, you're there all day.
But they're not doing performances and stuff, right? So they can whip through them, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, quickly. No, they go through them. It's one award after another. It's like
boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Well, but my point is that Beyonce lost the Best Music Film Award for Lemonade to Ron Howard's super bland documentary, The Beatles, 8 Days a Week, The Touring Years. And I'm like, if she lost that, if you didn't recognize Lemonade as a visual album, there's no way in hell you're going to vote for it for Album of the Year. Because that was all about the visual album. You know, that was, if that didn't win, there was no way that it was going to win Best Album of the Year. That's what I felt. I felt like I thought that award was a lock. You know, good God, how could that not be the award she wins, if nothing else? And so when she didn't get that, I mean, I know it's the Beatles and people maybe just saw the name The Beatles, but I'm sorry, Beyonce Lemonade, visual album, that was the big news of, you know, I mean, I just thought that as an artistic achievement and whatever you thought of it, that was where the action was. And if she didn't have support for that, it wasn't going to translate to just the audio only. So did you think it was shocking? It was upsetting? It's Grammy's so white?
No, I don't. And here's the thing. There's some mixed messages going on here. Okay, so Chance the Rapper wins 2 awards. I think he won Best Rap Album and
Best New Artist.
And Best New Artist.
Which they should redub Best Breakthrough Artist and not worry about, because every kid can post YouTube videos when they're 12. So just get over it and call it Breakthrough Artist and your job is done.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. What I would say is there's a guy who never actually released an album. Everything was streaming, so much so that he thanked SoundCloud, okay? The streaming service SoundCloud for helping him out, okay? So there was never an album there. But SoundCloud anybody can listen to it, right? You don't need to have a subscription or even a, you know, there's no free versus, well, they do have a free versus premium now, but you get everything. Beyoncé's album and the videos were all on Tidal, which is probably its third or fourth or maybe even fifth in line when it comes to these music streaming services. I don't have a subscription to it. I don't know if you have one, Michael, but most people don't. And so the Recording Academy skews a little bit older because, of course, these are, you know, veteran artists who are in the Academy making, you know, doing the voting.
So they're not streaming as much.
They're not streaming as much. Now, mind you, it was the Beyoncé album, both the album and the videos were exclusive to Tidal for maybe a week or two, but then they were on Apple Music, but they're still not on Spotify. I still can't find them on Deezer. I can buy the album on Amazon if I want to, but, you know, who uses CDs anymore? So it really, I think, in that regard, was a disservice to her because I don't necessarily know a lot of people. Everybody, you know, all the music critics love it, and they said it was the best album of the year. But how many Recording Academy voters actually were able to listen to it?
Don't they got access to the music? Don't they, like the Oscar voters? They get access to all the music they want?
Yes, they do.
Well, then why? Then it's their choice not to listen to it.
Yes, I like I said, there might be some mixed messages here because, what I'm trying to say is, I don't think everybody always says, oh, well, that film didn't win because nobody saw the movie. Well, here I'm saying Beyoncé may not have won, not because her album wasn't better. You know, leaving that aside, it just might be not as many people heard the album.
Well, that's they have access to it. Unlike you, they have access to it.
So I would agree.
If they chose not to listen to it, that's got nothing to do with whether it's on Tidal and exclusive on Apple and not on Amazon or anything like that.
That very well may be true.
I have not one, not two, but 3 points to make.
Okay.
And then we'll be done, I think. Number one, 25 sold 20 million copies. Lemonade sold 2, and the other album sold 1 or 2 or 3 million copies. I mean, 25 is a monster smash hit. And I think for a lot of Grammy voters, that pull to this being a traditional album, to being what the record industry has known and understood for 40 years now, big blockbuster albums since the mid 70s with, you know, Fleetwood Mac Rumors, and there were big albums before that, but the sense of a big album selling a lot of copies, having a lot of hit singles, this sucker wasn't even on streaming services for like 6 months or a long time after it came out. So it's like, this is the way they've done it for so many years, and it's not happening anymore. And this is sort of the last gasp of 40 years of tradition in the rock and roll business of big blockbuster albums. And I think that pull, just, oh, this is what we've known. This is how we do it. And good God, I wish we could still do it, but it's not happening anymore. I think that was very powerful.
I think you're right. I think it's kind of much like they sometimes give, you know, Julia Roberts an Academy Award for a film, and you think, really, was she Best Actress this year? But it's more of a, hey, thank you for your career award. I'm not saying that's this case, but it's more of a, hey, thank you for boosting up our entire industry.
Yeah. So I thought, well, is there a tendency in the Grammys to give album of the year to the big best-selling album? I thought, is that true? I went back and looked through 20, 30 years, and no, it's not true. There's no particular pattern one way or the other. Sometimes Thriller will win. Sometimes the big album won't win. Sometimes there's no huge gap, so you're not really making a comparison that's valid. You know, one album sells 8 million and the other one sells 14. Well, 14 is bigger, but 8 million isn't nothing to sniff at. But as I went back and started to look at these acts like U2 and Taylor Swift, all these people, and try to measure out what was going on, I was reminded again of how far we've fallen. All these artists, Beyonce, Kanye, Lady Gaga, Bruno Mars, Rihanna, Usher, U2, Lady Antebellum, John Mayer, when you go look at their last 4 or 5 albums or 10 albums, you just see their sales figures plummet down to nothing. I mean, nothing. It's there's some of them aren't going gold anymore. And it's kind of shocking to realize it. And this is not atypical at all, but I got back to 2005 when Ray Charles won. And that was a year where the best-selling album did not win. He won for Genius Loves Company, not a good album, but it sold 5 million copies, and he won Album of the Year. Also a person of color, by the way. The people who lost were Green Day. An American Idiot sold 14 million copies. Alicia Keys with The Diary of Alicia Keys, 8 million copies. Usher with Confessions, 20 million copies. And Kanye West with his debut album, College Dropout, 5 million copies. holy moly, that is more than they probably sold all year this year today. I mean, that is just to remind us of how dramatically the industry has changed.
Yeah, well, we also have streaming services now where, you know, it's gotten to a point where in an animated film like Zootopia, you have one of the animated characters saying, CDs, who uses these anymore?
Yeah, and there are a few exceptions. Taylor Swift, Adele, maybe, though it could just be momentum because her last album sold 45 million copies. This one has sold 20. Maybe her next one will sell 10 or 5, like you see with Norah Jones and some other people who have big, huge albums. And maybe Ed Sheeran. I kind of feel like his next album is going to sell copies and it appeals to an older audience. But the number of people who sell a lot of albums is vanishingly small. So then I said, well, wait a second. Album of the year, does it always go to white people? And no, it doesn't. You go back to the 70s. The 60s, there was just, I think, one person of color, Getz and Gilberto, won for their album. I think that was in the 60s. But in the 70s, 4 out of 10 Grammys went to, well, Stevie Wonder or a person of color. In the 80s, 2 out of 10 were won by people of color. In the 90s, 4 out of 10 were won. In the 2000s, 4 out of 10. So 40% in the 2000s, 40% in the 90s, 40% in the 70s. That's a long history of almost half of the awards being won by people of color. I don't think you can see any pattern. There's been a little bit of a lull in the last few years in this decade, but I don't think long term you think you can look at the Grammys and say, oh, they've been ignoring people of color.
Yeah, you know, I always find it. I don't want to get into the whole race discourse here, but remember I think right before the whole Oscar So White campaign started that year, I think the year prior, 12 Years a Slave won.
So, yeah, but it's totally valid because people aren't even getting work. Now, you're implying that because 12 Years a Slave won that Oscars aren't racist. But in fact, it's like the movies don't get made, the people don't get work as cinematographers or set designers or actors. Their stories aren't told. And when women and people of color and other minorities are given the chance to tell stories, they can reach a big audience and then they will have made movies that will be eligible for Oscars.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't think 12 Years a Slave says, oh, see, we're fine. I think that complaint was valid, but if you look at least at the big awards at the Grammys, there's a lot of diversity there.
Okay.
But there isn't diversity when it comes to Song of the Year and Record of the Year because people don't understand the difference.
Yeah, I did notice that actually.
I mean, it's true. Any song that wins Best Song of the Year is probably a beautifully made and recorded and produced song with a great arrangement and a great sound. And as Roy Halle, who worked with Simon and Garfunkel and Paul Simon for many years, has said, you know, two voices and a guitar is not easy to record. You know, don't think just because it seems simple that it's easy to do. So I don't want to downplay what went into creating Hello as a great, great record that sold a lot of copies. But the fact is, Formation obviously is the record of the year. It's not a song you want to hear people record and do their own versions of. That's why it didn't win Song of the Year. But if it was going to win a big award, it should have been Record of the Year because that's where it fits and makes sense. Hello, as Song of the Year, sure. Not that I'm actually dying to hear a lot of people cover that either, frankly. I think most people wouldn't be able to pull it off because it's mostly just about her vocal. It's not about a great melody particularly. But, you know, sure, why not? But Record of the Year, Hello, that's people who don't understand the difference.
Yeah, but which I would say is most Academy voters.
I guess so. You think they would know, though. It's their business.
Yeah. But you know the difference between a good book and a bad book. And what I'm referring to is it is time for us to check out Book Filter, a book lover's best friend. And Michael, what's your pick of the week, the book that you've selected with our listeners in mind?
Well, there's always so many good books. This week, there was a great sci-fi-ish book called Shadowbond, which is about the Twin Towers mysteriously reappearing in South Dakota in the present day. And at the same time, Elvis Presley's stillborn twin brother. He also shows up. So that's a fascinating book. Great reviews. I'm dying to read it. There's also The Dime, which is this mystery book by Kathleen Kent about a Brooklyn detective who heads to Dallas, Texas on a case, which is almost as hard to deal with as her girlfriend. So you got a lesbian detective in Brooklyn heading to Dallas. And then you have this other book, which I really like a lot, called Their Finest. It's by Lisa Evans. And the British title for this book was Their Finest Hour and a Half. Because it's about life during the Blitz, during the war, and they often called it Their Finest Hour. But this is called Their Finest Hour and a Half because it's about the making of a movie. And I would have absolutely said that this charming British novel would make a great movie. It's about a female scriptwriter working on a film in London during the Blitz. It's got great characters, but you know what? It's already a movie. It's coming out on April 7th. It stars Gemma Arterton and Bill Nighy as a vain aging actor. He's going to be great in this part because it's a great role. It's directed by a woman, Lone Scherfig. I say that in reference to our comments earlier. And I have to say, I picked up this book as light entertainment, but it's really, really good. A very substantial book. It's not that I would downplay light entertainment. That's hard to do too. But it's really far more textured and interesting than I expected. But that's not my pick of the week.
Wait, you mean all of those weren't your pick of the week? I know we like jumped right into the book filter segment from our Grammy coverage here. But good grief. I thought for sure one of these is going to be the book of the week.
My book of the week is Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. And you don't get much more press than George Saunders right now in the book world because they love him. He's published a number of collections of short stories, including 10th of December, his most recent one. Everybody loved it. I didn't get into it. I just have a block somehow with his short stories. And I felt I just got to put it aside. I'm going to try it again later when I'm in the better mood and I'm ready to give it another shot. Cause I felt the problem was with me, not the short stories. Cause it's not always about the material. Sometimes you're just not seeing that movie or listening to that album or reading that book at the right time. Well, now he's published his first novel. It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. It's about the day Abraham Lincoln as president buried his son, one of his sons. And he kept returning, and this is fact, to the crypt where the boy was. He kept returning to the graveyard like 2-3 times that day. He just could not go away. He was so heartbroken. And he went back again and again, and it's been recorded in the historical record. And I dove into this book, loved it immediately. I knew it was bold. People were saying how kind of groundbreaking it was. And at first, it seemed like this book was created from found text, meaning the beginnings of the book come from like, there's a line from a diary talking about a party the Lincolns were having. Then there's a line from a letter to someone and a line from a newspaper article. And pulling all this information from the historical record, they were telling the story of Lincoln's having a party at the White House while their son was ill upstairs and the boy dies. And I thought, oh my God, this is fascinating. He's written an entire book without writing a single word. He's just pasted together all these things. But then we get to the graveyard and suddenly it's like Our Town or Spoon River. Suddenly we're getting the voices of the dead and they are crowding around Lincoln and they're crowding around his son and they're crowding around each other. And these are the people who are trapped in the graveyard who haven't let go of the world. And they need to do that before they can go on to the other side. And it just goes on from there. And it's fantastical. It's a little weird. It's very much out there, though I think anybody who's read Spoon River or seen Our Town should be able to understand what's going on. But I really just thought it was really a masterpiece.
And do you think it will be a movie?
I do. And I think Tim Burton will ruin it. And I think Spielberg might ruin it. I don't know who should do it because it's a weird oddball thing. And maybe it shouldn't be a movie, but we'll have to find out.
Well, do you think we should actually like write to... Well, you said Tim Burton, no, Steven Spielberg, no, but if either one of them does it, that would kind of, you'd be disappointed.
I guess, yeah. Well, I don't know if I'd be disappointed, but I don't know if Spielberg is the right one to do it. Spielberg more than Burton, if I had to choose.
Well, who would be, the right person in your eyes?
I don't think it should be a movie.
Oh, okay. You think it will be, but shouldn't be. And if it is, it would be a big deal.
Yes. Ah.
Yes, that's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Do you think like people, when they're listening to this, they think, oh, you know, he's trying to move along and like they can actually hear me asking you those questions for like 5-6 minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, our first story is about Disney. Disney had a great first quarter, but because it was being compared to a record first quarter 1 year earlier, the numbers were down slightly. Mind you, they beat expectations. But while Rogue One was a billion-dollar hit, that can't compare to the $2 billion of Star Wars The Force Awakens. And next quarter, they have just one new movie opening in North America, the live-action Beauty and the Beast, and believe me, this is going to be a huge hit. Trust me.
Oh my God, it's going to be a big movie.
Yes. Still, one area of concern is ESPN. Disney pointed out the college playoff schedule was quirky this time around, and that didn't really help. But programming costs are going up and advertising is going down and the audience certainly isn't getting any bigger. Although actually they are getting bigger. It's just that there aren't more of them. They're just getting bigger.
Nice.
But now, does that mean the lure of going over the top with ESPN may prove too hard to resist? Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I think it is a big deal because that's their jewel in the crown, practically. You know, that churns out money. Movies, you got to make a new one every time, and they think they got that down pat. But boy, ESPN, a little crack in the thing of ESPN is concerning, and I do think that's going to make them want to push harder and take that gamble and go forward with going over the top.
Well, here's why I think they're going to go over the top. One,
that's where the money is.
Well, their CEO Bob Iger said, "Hey, you know these, you know MVPNs, these multi-video providers, i.e., these over-the-top services, are getting more and more interesting. Something is happening here. Okay, that's where the action is." So, and we all said, yeah, no duh. How come you haven't known that for ages? So by doing the HBO Now thing, effectively giving it like ESPN Go or ESPN Now, they will be able to turn to cable operators and say, hey, you know how we charge you $3 now? We want to charge you $4 a month per subscriber because, you know, if you still want it and you don't want us to go to fully go OTT, then you'll pay us for it. So I think that's definitely why they're going to do it, because one, their CEO said they were going to do it, and B, it gives them a better negotiating stance.
All right.
The crowdsourced volunteer editors at Wikipedia have made a decision. You can't trust the Daily Mail. The UK tabloid is one of the most popular news sites in the world and has inspired copycat layout and clickbaiting by everyone from Huffington Post to the New York Post. But it's also one of the least reliable news sources, filled as it is with gross exaggerations, poorly fact-checked stories, and whoppers that often seem invented out of whole cloth and prove completely untrue. That's not true, Michael. They're just alternative facts. And Wikipedia has had enough. It's been flagging the Daily Mail since 2015 and finally decided enough was enough. While there's no permanent outright ban as such, using the Daily Mail as a source of facts will be prohibited in all but the rarest of circumstances. We call it extreme vetting. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. One down, 274,563 sites to go. I do think, you know, a lot of sites you can ban because they're not real sites, and it's very quick and easy to do. This is a major, hugely popular website. With a big name. It's not a nobody or a nothing or some shadowy thing coming out of the Ukraine. It's a genuine news website. And it is a big step to say, hey, you know what? This is on our blacklist. And it should be, because time and again in the entertainment industry, we've seen stories and we're like, dudes, this is in the Daily Mail. Why are you talking about it as if it's real? You know, come on.
Well, you know, I always wondered, Baz Bamigboy, who is their movie guy, and you know him, we've all met him.
Do I?
Yeah, he's been in Cannes for years. I've known him for like 15 years at least. He's a really nice guy, writes interesting stuff, but then it gets put in the Daily Mail. So it's like, great, you know? And he always starts off, you know, saying, you know, at any press conference, hi, Baz Bamigboy, the Daily Mail. It's like, you might want to leave that last part out.
Well, I wrote for the New York Post, so I have nothing but empathy for him. You know, it's like, hey, I did stuff that I was perfectly proud of and not ashamed of in the New York Post, so it can be done.
True. Is virtual reality the new 3D?
Ha!
There, that got Michael's attention. Facebook placed working models of their Oculus Rift VR headsets in some 500 Best Buy stores. Now they're shutting down 200 of them for the very good reason that nobody really gave a damn. Some displays would often go days without anyone checking them out. The headset costs $600 and a touch controller another $200. In an investigation by Business Insider, sellers in charge of them said they sold just a few per week from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and that interest fell off a cliff after the holidays. Facebook and Best Buy say the decision is due to quote-unquote seasonal changes, which is, I don't know what season that is. But
it's more like climate changes.
Yeah, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, right?
Yeah.
This is early days. Everybody's doing it. There's no material. There's nothing for them to do with the headsets, but that content is coming. And I think that's when we'll get a better sense of what's going on. You got to have the technology, and you got to have the content, and you got to have lower prices. And that's when we'll get a fair test of whether this is something that will actually work in the home. There's no question virtual reality will have applications in medicine and other areas. Whether it's going to be an entertainment mode in the home, we all think it is because we've seen Star Trek, but who knows?
And as we might see with Apple later this year, it's more AR, augmented reality, that might catch on more than VR, virtual reality, where you have to have the goggles on your face and you can't see anything and you're blind unless you figure out some way to. I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, for Facebook and Oculus, this was a way to maybe get people to try it out more so than sell it. They wanted to introduce the technology to people, but then they realized, like,
Nobody's trying it out.
Well, not only that, but, you know, Best Buy stores, these big box electronics stores, you know, they still have foot traffic, but not nearly as much as they did years ago.
It's empty when I walk into Best Buy in the suburbs. And according to the story in Business Insider, some worker in California said, you know what, their software bugs would often make the demo headsets unusable. I don't know how that reflects, but, you know, it's a first generation of a new technology in the public eye. I imagine they probably did have some snafus to work through. I don't think it's like 3D, where to me it never makes sense that it might work in the home. It just made no sense to me that people would want to watch 3D on their TV. I'm not saying that they're going to want to watch, put on virtual headsets and be, you know, do that in their house, but they might. The technology is cool enough and you got a killer app. Why not? But we'll have to see. But certainly price has to come down, more content available, and then we'll have a chance to find out.
Could you imagine all those people walking around their living rooms with VR headsets on? I would invest in like shin guards, you know?
Well, you'd have to have a safe space. It's true. So apartment in New York, less likely, or you just sit down like you see in some of their ads.
Yeah. Nick Cannon is quitting his hosting gig on America's Got Talent. He says NBC was very unhappy with a racial joke he made on a Showtime stand-up special, saying he lost his real N-word card when he began hosting the show. Because now that he's on America's Got Talent, all these white people show up and he can't make the same jokes to a mixed race audience. Cannon announced in a lengthy Facebook post that this put him in a dark place and he felt he was giving up his right of speech and authenticity. So he's done. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal in a way. You don't want to mess with a franchise. I don't think Nick Cannon is that essential to America's Got Talent. They've had other hosts before and they will again. But, you know, he's an amiable host. I'm sure I didn't see the Showtime special. I assume the joke he made came off good-naturedly, and I have no idea why NBC made an issue out of it. They're just being idiots. It was a Showtime special. It wasn't creating a ruckus. Nobody was saying, Nick Cannon hates white people. So I don't know why they made a fuss. They're stupid.
Well, yeah, and I think really, we talked about this before the show, it was probably some lawyer somewhere going, oh, you know, there's a disparagement clause in his contract, and by law, you know, we technically should warn him. And you know what? There's a way to do things and a way not to do things. Obviously, you chose the way not to do things because he got so upset that he's leaving.
And now everybody knows the joke.
Yes, that's true.
We repeat it here because we're white.
Well, and, you know, hello, Streisand effect. Time Warner had a good quarter, beating expectations and beating the results from 1 year earlier. Pretty much every division had something positive to say, from hit films like Fantastic Beasts to TV and beyond. They say Westworld on HBO averaged 13 million viewers, though we don't have weekly tracking to show where it started and where it ended. And speaking of OTT, they say HBO Now, the standalone streaming subscription service that we just talked about, it now has 2 million paying users. They say it hasn't cannibalized regular HBO, that it puts them in a stronger position for renegotiations with cable operators, and they plan to make it available around the world, starting with Brazil, Argentina, and Spain. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for Time Warner, right? Everything's firing on all cylinders. They're doing great.
Absolutely, and you can also tell where their secondary market is. It's in the Spanish-speaking world, in the Latin American world.
Oh, and you know, I think it's just with skinny bundles coming along, maybe we'll get some downward pressure on both our cable bills and the annual 200 plus we pay for the cable set-top box, which apparently will remain in place. But you know, when people can go to OTT, maybe they're going to have to rethink those fees. Maybe they're going to scale them down or scale them off.
Yeah, that whole set-top box thing still irks me that the FCC didn't get rid of it.
Been irking me for 20 years.
Yeah, well, now it's really irking me. I mean, you know, I'm writing a letter to somebody, somewhere.
Well, you should.
Last week, we talked about the battle royale between music subscription services. Now let's focus on Spotify. They've got twice as many paid subscribers as Apple, but they've delayed going public with the company again. Now insiders say they may do an IPO, say, in 2018. Why? Because Wall Street is not happy with their numbers. Go figure. They're growing, of course, but so are costs. And once upon a time, growth was all you needed, but now Wall Street wants to see an actual path to profitability. Shocking. So Spotify continues to work on renegotiating its contracts with labels, these record labels. In return, the major labels say, hey, sorry if you can't have a hugely successful business without piggybacking on all the music we funded. But if you want access to our library, you're going to have to pay. And artists say Spotify thinks it's paying too much. It's not paying enough. That's a problem. So is the fact that Spotify has taken out two huge loans. One loan for $500 million paid huge penalties if the company didn't go public in January of 2017. Oops. The next loan is for $1 billion. Oopsier? I don't know what the adjective there is.
Big deal. Oopsier is good. Oopsier is good. Okay.
Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. We should have talked about this last week. But yeah, Spotify, that's kind of on the ropes, isn't it?
Well, it's not necessarily on the ropes. I mean, these are, convertible debt is basically what we're talking about here. And you basically want to convert it for shares of a company that you're buying at a discounted rate. And if you can't buy the shares at a discounted rate, well, then you have to service the debt. That's basically what's happening there. So this kind of stuff is done all the time. I think that I don't necessarily know why they didn't want to go public. Now, they easily could have.
Because their numbers suck, because the more success they have, the more money they have to pay out. It's not they don't have a viable business model yet, much like Uber, which depends on people working for free, pretending not to be employees, bringing their own car, and they still get funded they still have debt of like $2 billion a year. You know, it's not a viable business.
Well, you know what I think is, I think ultimately Spotify will cut good deals with the record companies. And we know why, Michael. We know why that's going to happen, because the record companies do want to see them go public. And why is that?
Because they want competition. They don't want it to be just Amazon and Apple.
Well, that's number one. And number two is, remember, they own some equity in Spotify, if you recall. Equity they don't have to share with their artists.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be why. Saturday Night Live hit a five-year high in overnight ratings thanks to its focus on politics and the constant promoting of the show by an angry President Trump. He apparently didn't weigh in on the show this weekend, which featured Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer and Kate McKinnon as both Jeff Sessions and Kellyanne Conway. That didn't stop the show from continuing to grow its audience. The variety series is averaging some 10 million viewers this season, up 22% from 1 year earlier. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Saturday Night Live, it astonishes me how durable it's been over the years when I hadn't watched it for a long time. Now I have to watch it. I watched it this week. I skimmed through it. You know, I thought Melissa McCarthy's work was the best work she's done in 10 years in all her movies. But, this week's skit was the same as last week's skit. You know, whatever.
I thought that was a mistake, actually. I thought, you know what? It was so good the first time when Melissa McCarthy played the press secretary to Donald Trump. Sean Spicer, that should have been it. They should not have redone
it. Just do something new. Don't do it again.
Yeah. And unfortunately they did the same exact thing and it wasn't.
Yeah, they could have
funny.
Her back room talking to Trump. They could have anything, you know, but they just don't repeat. It was literally the same jokes.
Yeah.
Except this time, instead of she lifting up the podium, it was a mobile platform, whatever. Who cares?
Yeah. It's like they started with the ending. They were like, oh, we should have had a Segway platform. That would have been funnier. Can we write a whole, set around that? But yeah,
I think they're just the same thing, but bigger. Oh, well, but the ratings are bigger, so they're happy. 10 million viewers a week.
Now, speaking of ratings, I'm going to skip a story and then go back to one. Apparently, okay. Donald Trump really is good for CBS. Stephen Colbert has generated a lot of buzz since the election of Trump by focusing like a laser on re-embracing the political edge that brought him fame in the first place. And now it's bringing him ratings. For the first time since his debut on Late Night, Colbert topped Fallon in total viewers for an entire week. On the downside, it's not that Colbert has gained so many new eyeballs, it's that Fallon's audience is tuning out in significant numbers. And those viewers aren't tuning in to Colbert or Kimmel et al. They're just turning it off, really. Season to date, Fallon is averaging 3.3 million viewers nightly, but you can chart the slide almost day by day. And for the week ending January 30th, Colbert reached 2.77 million viewers compared to Fallon's 2.76 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? Late night host has slight fall in ratings. And really, it is about Jimmy Fallon falling. Nobody else is gaining. It's just him falling. And God help us, got to get political again. All I can think of, the only thing I can point to, is his disastrous toadying up to Trump. And I think that continues to haunt him, that the young people who watch his show, who think he's kind of cool and fun and friendly, were like, ew.
Yeah,
wow.
No, I agree.
And that has poisoned him. And he really needs to work hard to make, and he's had some political people on, and he needs to do more. He needs to just show that he has some soul inside. Oh, hi, Mr. Mussolini. You know, he needs to do something, because I really do think that's what it is. Because what else, the hell else could it be? You know, he sat in the lap and played googly eyes with, you know, Trump, and his viewers don't like that because they are vehemently anti-Trump and he's losing them.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. It's not only with the Tonight Show, we're seeing it with the Celebrity Apprentice, which just may have, you know, kind of outstayed its welcome, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people aren't tuning in specifically because it is a Trump property. We see the same thing with Ivanka Trump's line of clothing at Nordstrom last week. It's
they're hurting the brand.
Right, exactly. And people said that this would happen if he were president, and were president in a way that he ran, which was very divisive. And so I agree with you. I think that moment, and it's such a vivid moment to so many people, in which, you know, Jimmy Fallon reached over his desk and tussled Donald Trump's hair to show that it was real. I think it really, really hurt his reputation, really, his brand.
Yep.
As far as Stephen Colbert is concerned, what's interesting to me is that David Letterman, you know, he'd do the political joke now and again, but the show wasn't political. Really, the late night with Stephen Colbert has become a political show. It's almost like, you know, the Colbert Report, but with guests.
I gotcha.
I mean, but it is funny. I have to say, he really is on. He's doing exactly what he is good at.
That usually pays off dividends.
Yes. Now, speaking of doing what you're good at, there is somebody who's not going to be doing what they're good at for very long. The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. She is retiring. The diva announced she would be recording one more album with Stevie Wonder, assisting on several tracks, and she's essentially done with touring, though Franklin isn't saying she won't sing ever again. Just don't expect her to go on her tour bus and crisscross the country anymore. By the way, Franklin is averse to flying, so, you know, she'd have to be on a tour bus. Yes. She expects to release her final studio album in the fall. In similar news, NBC's Bob Costas is stepping down as the face of the Olympics for U.S. viewers. Mike Tirico is stepping in while Costas scales back other work and, you know, takes it easy. Are these retirements a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, they're a big whoop, of course, but Aretha is doing it right. And I just thought of this. Aretha is doing it right because she announced it in advance and says, I've got one more album in me. I'm touring one more time. And you believe her because she's, you know, getting on in years and it's reasonable to believe. Bob Costas, dear God, you should have made the decision before the Olympics. Let that be your final Olympics. That would have helped, you know. I'm kind of like, oh, he's already gone. You know, yeah. I would have loved. I mean, I watched him, but it would have been nice to know that that was our last Olympics with Bob Costas, because he's been great at it. And he's sort of the face of the Olympics now for North American viewers. So, you know, missed opportunity there.
And for people in the St. Louis area, I mean, Bob Costas is so associated with sports in this country. But, it, you know, for people in the St. Louis area, it's been for decades. I mean, Bob Costas used to be on the radio when he was 11 years old in the St. Louis area, known as Little Bobby Costas, because he knew everything about baseball. He could tell you the stats and the football stats, and he was better than some of the sportscasters. And so, you know, of course, doing the Olympics was just a natural. But I agree with you. I'm a little shocked that he didn't announce it last year or announce it going into the Winter Olympics for next year and then say, look, these Winter Olympics, they're going to be my last, and then kind of take it from there and kind of pass the torch. Instead, it's just, no, I'm not going to do them anymore. But, you know, we said the same thing about American Idol, that they're not doing it anymore. But you never know. Ryan Seacrest has hardly returned from his first vacation in a decade, and they're already trying to bring back American Idol. This time it would be on NBC, which is kind of odd since NBC already has The Voice running year round. On the other hand, NBC also has Simon Cowell on America's Got Talent. Apparently, the production company behind Idol is missing its ratings juggernaut, which was still pulling in solid numbers toward the end of its epic run. Some might see giving it a rest as a good way to preserve the brand, but they'd rather just get back on the air pronto. You know, money actually helps. Actually, they like the money. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because it's a big mistake.
Yeah, I agree.
It's mistakes for everybody. It's a mistake for the production company because we're not waiting for it to come back yet.
No.
You know, rethink the puppy maybe and bring it back in 3 or 4 years and you might have something, especially if you freshen it up. Number two, NBC is fixing a problem they don't have. The Voice is declining a bit in ratings, but shoving American Idol into the other, you know, the the one idea is that maybe they'll just stop one of the runs of The Voice. Why the hell would you stop a higher rated show to bring back American Idol? It's just like what they're doing with the Today Show. They're firing on all cylinders. They're cashing up on Good Morning America. They're raking in the bucks. And now they're going to supplant their one of their hours and throw in Megyn Kelly. It doesn't make any sense to me. You're damaging a brand that's working.
Los Angeles is cracking down on casting workshops that prey on hopeful actors. The district attorney says these are scams that amount to pay for play, or in the case, pay to audition. And that's against the law. It's the result of a year-long investigation and an undercover actor who got to play a struggling actor while actually working for law enforcement. I think that they recruited that person by saying, look, you're going to be on 21 Jump Street, but for real. Now, will that be a good thing to put on their resume, you think? The whole acting thing? I don't know. One such casting workshop has already shut down in the wake of the action by the district attorney. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because, you know, they're ripping people off. People who are thinking, all right, this person has some association with, you know, the Law and Orders franchise. And so I'll pay to be in this workshop and they'll see me and maybe they'll say, you're perfect for this part. You can understand why the actors do it. It also reveals a problem, which is that casting directors, especially associate casting directors and people lower down on the scale who don't have their name above the title in terms of casting, they make very poor money. And so you have people, perhaps not badly intentioned, who say, hey, I can make some extra bucks on the side when I'm not working. You know, it's seasonal work as casting directors often, and it's also not that high paid. And if you're not the big kahuna, you're not making a lot of money. And so they need work. And this was one way for them to get work. It's the wrong decision. It's the wrong choice. And it has tainted themselves and their brand. But it does point out the fact that, hey, you know what? You're not paying some of these people enough money. It's not big names going out here and doing it that much. It's more like people with a nominal link to shows and stuff doing it because they're trying to pay the bills. And then it got perverted and twisted out of place.
Yeah. And I always thought actors wanted pay or play deals. But I think that's when you sign on to a film, not, you know, pay to audition.
Exactly.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And really, I guess this week, how this news will affect our listeners, at least here in the U.S. and actually overseas as well. It will affect the programming you're watching from Viacom networks. In fact, it will affect the networks Viacom owns. And ultimately, all of that content gets shown not only here in the U.S., but overseas as well.
But the story begins with Disney, because Iger at Disney said in a conference call with reporters, you know, I know I'm supposed to leave, but you could talk me into maybe hanging around a little bit longer.
Yeah, which is another way of saying, I'm going to say this. So last year, our profits are down in the fourth quarter, but I might stick around for a little while. So he kind of said that kind of in, you know, right after saying that we beat expectations, kind of, we didn't beat expectations. You know, it was kind of a way to hide, you know.
Bad news in their fourth quarter.
No, but they didn't have great news either, so.
Only if you are an idiot and think you should always have to grow every single quarter compared to 1 year earlier from now until the end of time. When you look back and you say, oh, they had a $2 billion movie, and this time they had a $1 billion movie, you don't think disaster. You think, well, one was very profitable, and the other one was even more profitable. But unless you're unable to put it into context, you shouldn't say that this quarter was bad. It was not bad. And so there was no bad news to hide.
I'm really surprised, though, that Bob Iger would say this, because from people I know who work directly with him, he has told them, no, I am out. This is it, 2018. I am done. I have written it to the board.
It's
I have
stone.
Talked to the board. Yeah, and I'm gone. So start looking for replacements. However, that was also when they had, you know, kind of a succession order, which has since fallen apart.
He's 66 years old. That's right. He's 66. So he'll be 67. So you know what? Another 3 or 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, you know, 70 is the new 55, right? I mean, seriously, though, that he's healthy. He's good. He's doing a great job. He's got a massively successful company. There's nobody to take over. It's always hard to find a good successor and leave them in place and let them know they'll eventually get to take control, but not yet. And so there's nobody there to take over for him. He's healthy. He's fine. He's having fun. Why would he quit? What's he going to do for the next 20 years?
Well, you know, do what some other folks do, which is go and start other companies. You know, I remember back in the 90s when I was working at Creative Artists Agency, Ron Meyer had just left. He left to go to Universal Pictures, and he came back about 2 years later, and he was talking about the transition between Sidney Shanberg and oh my gosh, I'm forgetting his name now, and I really shouldn't be. Lou Wasserman. Between those two, who ran the company for decades, and Sidney Shanberg had been there for 25 years. And he said at the time, this was Ron Meyer saying, you know, we got there and there was so much wrong with the place. You really shouldn't run a company for 25 years. You know, a company like that, the leader should not be there for 25 years. Well, lo and behold, Ron Meyer has been there for 25 years and I don't see him leaving.
Well, and you know, Bob Iger's only been president and CEO of Disney since 2000, and then he only succeeded Michael Eisner in 2005. So he's only been in charge for 12 years.
Right.
However, well, this is Disney, and they're doing great, and their success is huge, and everybody wants to be like Disney. And that's kind of what's happening at Viacom, right?
Right. So Disney has these little silos, like they have television, Buena Vista Television, and then they have Pixar and Disney Animation over in the other corner, and then they have the whole Star Wars Lucasfilm world, and then they have the Marvel world. And so that it's just like, actually, if you think about
Disney
it.
Disney World, the Tomorrowland, Pioneer Fantasyland.
Right. Which, by the way, Euro Disney, they're buying out the rest of Euro Disney. So they're buying it in whole.
Okay.
Breaking news. Or at least breaking news from over the weekend. That said, Paramount, Viacom, really, the parent company of Paramount, wants to do the exact same thing. But here's the question that I have. Can Viacom follow this Disney model where they have silos like the Marvel and the Pixar and actually make it work?
Absolutely. All they need to do is find a property as valuable and world famous as Star Wars or the Marvel Universe or the 70 years of Disney Animation or the 20 years of unparalleled success of Pixar, where you become one of the most famous brand names since actually Disney as far as a movie is concerned. So yeah, it's easy. All you need is massively successful properties that have already proven themselves worldwide.
So it's impossible.
Well, I'm just saying it's not a model that works just because they do it. Oh, well, we'll have this silo and that. It's like you can't have a silo of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That doesn't work. You know, it's like, yeah, you can have a franchise and spin off of you, but it's not like this never ending stream of properties that you can exploit in 1,000 different ways. It's a valuable property. But, you know, you get my point that the Star Wars brand and Marvel and Disney and Pixar are far more rich properties with huge possibilities in theme parks and TV and movies than most things you've ever heard of.
Correct. And so what we're talking about here is, as we all know and talked about in the months and weeks past, Viacom, bit of a problem child right now. And the owners, the Redstone, said, oh, you know what we're going to do is we're going to combine it with CBS, okay, which we also own a majority of. And then CBS can kind of buttress up Viacom and we can get that Les Moonves guy who's done such a good job at CBS to take over Viacom and like save it for us. And then they decided, okay, that's not going to work actually. And so now they actually have to come up with a plan to turn Viacom around. And that's really what we're talking about here. Viacom owns Paramount. It owns all these cable networks. And so they're going to start siloing these different properties within Viacom to try and, I don't know, revive the company.
Well, they do have Star Trek. And if you say, all right, we want to focus on Star Trek and treat it the same way they treat Star Wars. And that has, you know, they have a TV show coming up on Star Trek. It's going to be on an app somewhere. It's not going to be on CBS, but they have the Star Trek film franchise. And you can look at that and say, we need to do this more focused. We need to be more specific. We have all the books. We have the classic library. We have the new movies. We have a TV show. We have the old TV shows. We need to focus on this brand and be more specific about it. That makes sense. And that is a very valuable universe with lots of books spun off in the Star Trek world. You could have a movie series spun off of at the Star Trek Academy or a TV series and network from the Star Trek Academy. You could have an action film set in the Klingon world. You know, who knows what might work? It's not as obviously possible or successful as Star Wars, but it could happen. So it's not out of the question, but there aren't that many properties that you can do that with.
No, but they have SpongeBob, right?
Yeah, and he's being turned into a Broadway musical. So I don't feel like they're not exploiting stuff. They've got School of Rock, the movie. That's becoming a TV show. I mean, everybody does this. Saying you're going to do it doesn't somehow make it different. But perhaps if you have something that is rich in exploitation, it can work. And I think in the TV section is where they really are focused first. And that's where they said this thing like, hey, you know what? We've got all these channels. We've got more channels than almost anybody. We need to start paying attention here. And what they've said is we're going to have our flagship six. These are going to be our six big kahunas because they all have specific major brands, often that travel the world. And beyond that, we've got other channels. But these six are where we're going to focus. This is where our money is going to go. This is where our original content is going to go. We've got Spike TV, which isn't a good name, and they've switched it to the Paramount Network. And that is going to be their main home for scripted fare. Then they have Nickelodeon. We understand that. Nickelodeon Junior. They have MTV. They have Comedy Central. And they have BET. And when you say those names, you can hear, yeah, they've got some specific identities. They all have a global presence. They have all delivered movies. So part of their flagship six in the cable world is to say, we're going to have movies with the Nickelodeon brand and the MTV brand and the Comedy Central brand. And I'm like, you do that already, don't you?
Well, they should be. They're just not doing it.
They do. They have Nickelodeon movies and BET movies, and maybe not BET, but they've had MTV movies and Nickelodeon movies. And, you know, MTV and Comedy Central aren't doing great. So, again, you've got these flagship brands that are not firing off cylinders the way, say, Star Wars and Marvel were, or Pixar when they bought that company. So they bought those companies at their peak. Well, you've got MTV. They're trying to figure MTV out. So to act like, well, now we can spin off movies from MTV. It was like, well, really? You know, you got to fix the cable channel first.
Yeah, well, you know, MTV has kind of had an identity crisis for some time now.
That's right. And they're not going to do scripted fare there. So that takes away the few modest successes they've had, like Teen Wolf and other stuff, and sticks them in the music and reality business. But, you know, maybe they'll make a watch. But I don't know. I went through the Paramount library to see what are they not exploiting? What do they really need to build on? There's not a lot there. It's a little hard. Star Trek is the big one. I mean, there's stuff they could do. Do they own the rights to Raiders? Could they do another young Indiana Jones TV show or a movie? I mean, my God, they're so old, Harrison Ford. Eventually, they're going to do a new indie movie, and it's going to have a younger actor. But they could do the TV series again, and without George Lucas turning it into homework, that could be international in scope. That could have an international cast. That could play well all over the world. But, you know, Naked Gun, Team America, the guys from South Park, young Sherlock Holmes. I mean, you're really stretching to find stuff that they can exploit, and it's certainly none of it has the feel of Star Wars or the Marvel Universe. Once you get past Star Trek, I don't see what they're going to build on.
Well, given the current president's suggestion that we do away with all financial regulations, they could, you know, maybe The Big Short could become a sequelized series.
Well, it already is.
Exactly.
But they do have an upcoming slate. Not huge. There's not a lot of stuff. The cupboard is kind of bare, frankly, as far as 2017 and 2018. But they have Ghost in the Shell, assuming that isn't troubled by accusations of yellowface, and that could be an issue. If the movie's really good, it won't matter. But if it's on the bubble or whatever, it could be a problem. They've got Baywatch, the movie. They've got Transformers. They have another Cloverfield, and then it gets a little, not much. There's Mission Impossible in 2018. So, and of course there's always Star Trek, but it's, they don't have a strong slate of movies coming up. They don't have a strong slate of movies in pre-production that I can see. Their flagship six includes channels that are kind of weak right now. They have name recognition like MTV. There's value in them, but I don't think that it's obvious that they've, oh my God, why haven't we been exploiting this great idea? So once you get beyond Star Trek, I don't think they have the brands the way Disney did when they bought Marvel and they bought Star Wars and they bought Pixar. They bought hugely valuable properties with rich histories that can be exploited eight ways to Sunday. Viacom doesn't have that right now.
No, they do not.
I would agree. Great idea, but saying you've got a silo does not magically make properties that are modestly successful become hugely successful.
What if they took a corn silo and moved it onto the studio lot in Hollywood?
That's where you go when you do a bad job.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so then maybe bad idea. But that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week, and hopefully not Viacom, but Inside Baseball at least. And it also wraps up our show, which you can subscribe to in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where you can find our show. We do appreciate it when you rate and review and subscribe to the show. It helps us out. And if you can find it there, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us. At showbizsandbox is our handle on Twitter, or you can search for us on Facebook and up our page at showbizsandbox should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Much like we have a website, showbizsandbox.com, they have a website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's white people, please stop apologizing for winning awards.com.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry...
Nothing, not a giggle, nothing, oh well.
Well, you know, I just figured...
That's okay.
Look, if Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there isn't there, go to thehuffingtonpost.com. MichaelGiltz.com is where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Free David Wilde! Free David Wilde!
I don't think he's captured. I think he's just living the life we all want to live and actually has to work.
Then damn you, David Wilde! Damn you, David Wilde!
You're just jealous.
I am.